So, I have made a couple of videos criticizing communism, especially Antifa. And during those videos, I pointed out the statement that I still stand by it, which is that many criticisms that Karl Marx had towards capitalism were fairly accurate. Stop.
Stop. Not this time. Not this fucking time. No! No, 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 no! No! No, 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 no! No! Not this fucking time! No fucking way! No fucking way! No fucking way! Baby.
So listen, I like V, and he often talks a lot of sense. We battled the alt-right together, and I generally think he makes great content. But I can't let this unmitigated doling out of blue pills go unanswered. V made two videos recently. You can watch these in your own time. I'll link them in the show notes. In these videos, he talked about how grim life was in the industrial era of the 19th century and generally peddled some Charles Dickens-style sob stories of poor orphans and kids working in bad conditions in factories and how, basically, government intervention and regulation came to the rescue to help us have the nice lives that we all have today. He even went as far as to say that life on medieval farms was probably better than in the cramped cities of the Victorian era. And he suggested that they only moved to such hellholes because they were forced to by disease and famine. Now, while all this makes for a nice story, in this video I'd like to focus on the facts and ask how much of V's peon to benevolence and government is really true. Now, prior warning, this video is going to be rather stats heavy. I'll be drawing facts and figures from a number of sources. In the interests of academic integrity, let me list them here up front. Dean and Cole's classic British Economic Growth, 1688 to 1959. Agnes Magnusson's Contours of World History. Stephen Broadbury's British Economic Growth, 1270 to 1870. B.R. Mitchell's British Historical Statistics, also by B.R. Mitchell, Economic Development of the British Coal Industry, 1800 to 1914, Peter G. Lindhart and Geoffrey G. Williamson's English Workers' Living Standards During the Industrial Revolution, A New Look, and finally, this M.Phil thesis by J.F. Martin called The Government and Control of the British Coal Industry, 1914 to 18. In short, in this video, I am arguing that not a single one of the regulatory rules that V championed was required to make life better, and also that encroaching government regulation of British industry sowed the seeds for its eventual destruction. I'm going to make this argument in three sections. First, I will challenge V's claim that workers moved to the cities because of disease or hunger. The real reason was because workers' wages were higher in the city. Second, I will challenge V's claim that life was worse in the industrial era than it had been before. Third, using the British coal industry as a case study, I will challenge V's claim that regulation made things better for people, including children, in the industrial age. Alright, so the first thing to establish is that it is true that we see a general migratory pattern away from rural areas and into the cities, but it's also worth noting that this didn't exactly leave the countryside barren because the population itself was increasing. So as you can see here, the agricultural population was still practically doubled from 1701 to 1831, but in the same period, the total industrial population went from 5.8 million to over 14 million. Despite this, even though more people were being born everywhere, there were still net outflows from rural areas into industrial areas. And as you can see here, a lot of people ended up moving into London and also into the northwest. The distribution of the labour force thus moved from agriculture into industry. So as you can see, in 1801, there were 35.9% of people working on farms and fishing and so on. But by 1951, that number was only 5% because by this point, 49.1% of the country was now working down mines or in factories and so on. This is actually part of a much longer term trend that started as far back as 1270. We can see a general flow of people from the country to the cities, and I documented that historical development in my videos on the decline of feudalism and the rise of capitalism, which you should check out if you have not done so yet. But that does not mean that agriculture was in decline in Britain. In fact, as you can see here, from 1688 to 1770, it actually grew in real terms and as a percentage of national output. But rather, that industry was offering new business opportunities and pivotally higher wages for workers. People weren't moving out of desperation in most cases, they were moving to get paid more. Miners and factory workers consistently out-earned farm labourers. As you can see here, the rural workers constituted the bottom 40%, whereas the industrial workers, including the colliers and the cotton spinners, were in the top 50%. By 1805, you'd earn more than 24% working down a mine than you would on a farm. In fact, being part of the industrial class puts you an entire wage bracket above the farm labourers. So in this graph, you'd be part of that middle group. Is the story that V was telling starting to look a little bit more suspect at this point? So let's talk about living standards. At the very broadest level, GDP per capita in Britain started trending up after about 1600. As you can see here, GDP stagnated in the 1400s and the 1500s. During that period, real wages fell. So life for your average peasant was arguably better in the Middle Ages than it was in the early Renaissance. One of the reasons for this fall in wages is because labourers were now working longer hours. But you have to remember that in 1350, say, most peasants would still be chained to the land of a feudal lord and effectively had no money or wages. They just worked for food. Whereas by 1550, most peasants were working for themselves and paying rent. In any case, after this point, GDP keeps going up and real wages across every sector trend upwards. In fact, Britain had the highest growth rate in the world from 1500 to 1820. At the same time as people were getting paid more, their cost of living was decreasing, as you can see here. Romantics like V might imagine that living in the country is a better standard of life than in a cramped industrial city, but think of the availability of goods and services in a city versus in the middle of nowhere. Think of all the time saved from being able to exchange your wages for all of those goods and services. In fact, far from getting worse, the standard of living for the average industrial blue-collar worker in the UK rose by about 99.2% from 1781 to 1851. And throughout all of this period, there were no paternalistic, bleeding heart liberal laws being passed by anyone. Yet, life got better, GDP per worker became more efficient, and everyone was better off for it. You can see these things had nothing to do with regulations, and you cannot claim credit for a pre-existing trend because of some silly new law that you pass. Now, I want to address the child labour laws that V has championed so much and zoom in on just one industry during this period to take a look at the effects of such laws. I'm going to look at coal because the industry has very rich data that we can look at, and because it became a matter of regulation, government, and politics a lot sooner than most other industries. In fact, the first bit of government interference came in 1831 with the Truck Act, and it's really the 1842 Mines and Colliers Act that set things rolling. This act banned children younger than 10 from working in or around the mines, and also banned all females from being employed. I'm sure V is very happy about the passing of this law, but unfortunately it set a precedent for coal mining that the government could, and often would, intervene. So from this point onwards, the coal mine owners and the miners themselves both looked to Parliament to settle any disputes, including, and very often wages. The coal mines were among the first industry to unionize, and there were unions as early as the 1840s. After the Mining Act of 1860, there was also the formal role of the check weight man in every pit, who were usually experienced miners who were making a move into this more managerial role. It was often these check weight men who'd make the transition into being union bosses, who in some cases then got involved in politics. More on this in a bit. Now, one of the problems with coal is that the price fluctuates quite a lot with supply and demand. And naturally, this has a knock-on effect for the miners, whose wages naturally are going to fluctuate as the price of coal goes up and down. As you can see here, miners' wages don't trend upwards. They go up or down depending on the year. But the miners themselves, being largely ignorant of economic matters, only saw their wages were being slashed in these periods. Naturally, they didn't mind when the wages were going up, but when they went down, obviously they got angry, and it led them into striking against the owners, which they did rather frequently. This led to several deals between the unions, the owners, and Parliament to agree to a sliding scale arrangement, whereby miners' wages were formally attached to the price of coal, with a minimum guarantee and also a maximum ceiling. This was an early form of minimum wage, but there was a kind of logic to it, since the price of coal did largely determine the wages of the coal miners. However, in the 1870s, there was a downturn in the coal market, and many of the miners went on strike again. And during this period, the regulation and interference goes into overdrive, as you can see by this list. By 1900, more than half of all of the miners were unionized. Now, what were the effects of all of these progressive measures passed during this period? Well, productivity per worker fell. In fact, the output per worker numbers are dismal. How could it be that during the peak of the industrial era, as demand for coal is peaking, productivity actually goes into sharp decline? These are the effects of regulation. And one reason for this drop-off in productivity is because the workforce was aging. Not because the population as a whole was aging, but because the kids and the younger workers had been locked out of work by the new rules. Just as minimum wage today robs 17-year-olds of jobs and gifts them to 35-year-olds, so too did all the regulations of the 1800s lock the youth out of these well-paying jobs. So, for example, in South Wales, where once over 86% of the workforce were under 30, by 1913, that number was only 40%. In Cannock Chase, the numbers are even more stark, where once 78% of workers were under 30, by 1913, it was only 6%. This situation only got worse. In 1910, the South Wales miners went on a massive strike, only to secure a deal that got them paid at a worse rate than if they'd stayed on the sliding scale. Now you have a situation in which the coal mine owners are incentivized not to spend money on automation, but on government lobbying, and in many cases actively joining the Tory party and sitting in meetings. Likewise, the miners are incentivized not to think about being good at their jobs, but rather at becoming ever more militant in their unions and joining the Labour Party, which was up and running by this point, and then lobbying the government. So productivity just kept on going down. The owners had basically given up spending on capital investment. Miners in the UK were still using pickaxes as late as the 1960s. By the time World War I came along, the industry was effectively nationalised, and the results were predictably dismal. There was no entrepreneurship in the industry, no incentives for anyone to do much more than try and get a better deal from the government. And yes, the mines did limp on for another 50 years or so, but this is what happens when you get government involved in business. The whole thing turns to shit in the end. Now finally, what about those kids, including the ones who are no longer allowed to work down the mines. Now, this picture you can see on the screen here are American kids from 1910. And incidentally, child labor laws were not banned in the United States until the 1930s. And in their coal industry, none of these industry-destroying effects of regulation and so on during exactly the same period can be seen. In fact, their entrepreneurs invested in machinery, they automated, conditions got better in the American mines, but they didn't need the government to do it for them. Incidentally, by the time that the US government did ban child labor in the 30s, only 6% of children were working anyway. Funny though that happens, isn't it? But anyway, let's get back to these kids and who could have worked down the mines in the UK, but who were locked out by the new regulation. What happened to those kids? Well, a very good tale of what happens comes courtesy of Mr. Charles Dickens, because Oliver Twist, an orphan just a few years earlier, might have worked down a mine or in a factory. Instead, what happened to him? He has to face the mean streets of London, he gets involved with several undesirable types, and he basically ends up joining a gang. Does this sound familiar to anyone? So I ask you, who's the compassionate one here? Is it V and his bleeding heart wanting to save kids from working in factories? Or is it me who wants to save them from this terrible life of crime and gang membership? Young men like Oliver Twist could earn gainful employment before they were banned from doing so as putters in collieries. Now, even though a putter earned about half of what his adult colleagues would earn, that's still money. And by the time he was 17 or 18, he could likely transition into a better job. V, of course, would have him in school, learning to do media studies or something like that. But look at the opportunity to gain experience and to earn that V is denying this young boy here. V is condemning Oliver Twist to a life of crime, whereas I am giving him a pathway to prosperity. Till next time. And a very special thanks to Sir Percy Blakeney, the Crimson Satyr, Time Stealer, Nuri Nelson, Macadamia, Rosie Alpaca, Kuzga, Holy Spatula, Bruno Liette, Tragic Vision, Michael Burt, Ginger Bill, Blake Barrows, Charles Vincent, and Edward Darrah.